get it to you, but you probably figured that one out by yourself right now. Let me welcome, friends, Dan Barry. And Dan is an author. He writes This Land for the New York Times. It's a national column. He began back in 2007, but previously Dan wrote about New York column. He writes again for the New York Times, and he has been doing this since 1995. He also worked as the Times City Hall Bureau Chief, Long Island Bureau Chief, Acting Police Bureau Chief. He has a string of biographical achievements here, page 1, 2, 3, 4. No, and we're not going to go through those. But what I would like to do is link up with Dan Barry. And Dan, you're very welcome. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me, Adrian.
You're more than welcome. I gave a little of your background there. You're equally known, in addition to a columnist for the New York Times. Your books, your writings, again, award-winning. Which came first? You as a columnist, you as a writer, and where did the bug, and when did the bug hit you, you know, where you recognized that you were going to be a writer?
Well, Adrian, I guess pretty much in childhood, my mother was from Galway. She was from outside of the town of Gort in a place called Shenaglish, and she was just a natural storyteller. And my father grew up in New York City. He was a Depression-era kid, and he struggled through poverty and all sorts of misfortune. And so growing up and listening to the two of them tell their stories, and I also, as a kid, used to get beat up a lot, you know, get bullied. And so it just became natural, if you put all those elements together, the storytelling and the, you know, railing against the system and getting beat up, you wind up being a journalist because you want to tell stories that also hold people accountable. So I think becoming a newspaper reporter was first, and then the books followed later on.
The New York Times, you kind of jumped into the deep end of the pool there. What was that the first interview like for the job?
Well, first of all, it was I didn't jump in. I would say I waded in over 11 or 12 years of working elsewhere. I worked at a small newspaper in North Central Connecticut, and then I worked at the Providence Journal in Rhode Island. And so I'd been a reporter for well more than a decade before I got hired at the Times. But the first time, I had tried getting hired at the Times several times, even, you know, saying that I had a cousin who worked, you know, in the printing plant, but that level of nepotism didn't help me at all. I had several failures where I think most of my entreaties to be hired were ignored. But, you know, I say it was pretty much a clerical error that I wound up getting in. So, but by the time I got hired at the New York Times, I was already 36 and already losing my hair, so I wasn't a young buck.
Yeah, we and those of us who are Irish and of Irish extraction, there are certain topics which we are quite happy to stay away from, and I think it was you know, when the story unfolded that the Catholic care homes of Ireland, particularly the homes or the home in Tuam, run by the good sisters, that maybe there was the makings of a horrific scandal in terms of the disposition of the babies, the young children who were assigned indeed to similar institutions because they were indeed born illegitimately out of wedlock. When that news broke, there was great reluctance on both sides of the Atlantic to even, report on that subject. Then we heard, bits and pieces, dribs and drabs. But you took the story and the facts after you traveled to Ireland to research this, we can definitely call it a tragedy. Tell us a little bit about the motivation, and you indeed had read, as we do, and had, listened to reports about what, in hindsight, seems totally incredible, unbelievable.
Right.
Dan Barry, tell us about it.
Sure. And Adrian, what you're referring to is a story that I wrote and which appeared in the New York Times on Sunday, and it's called The Lost Children of Choom. And there's a video, a very effective documentary that accompanies it online. Like everybody else, I had heard about this story back in 2014 when a local woman named Catherine Corliss had said something is going on the old grounds of this mother and baby home. And what it is it's part of a continuum, isn't it? It goes back and back and back. It involves the Magdalene laundries.
Yeah.
It involves the priest scandals of the 80s and 90s. And now here are these are memories of the mother and baby homes, which had resurfaced a few years ago with that wonderful movie called Philomena. So Catherine Corliss basically told Ireland that she suspected with good reason that children who had been born out of wedlock and who had had the misfortune to be raised, at least in their early years, on this on the grounds of this mother and baby home, those who had died had apparently been buried on the grounds in parts of an old septic system. There's been some misunderstandings over the years about what she was alleging and what's been discovered. She never said that 796 babies were buried in a septic tank. That's not the case. What happened was she was doing a basic local history of the old mother and baby home that used to loom over a corner of Choom from 1925 to 1961. And the building already had an air of sorrow to it because it had been built as a workhouse in 1846 and had taken in countless numbers of famine victims over the years. And, it was just a sorrowful place. And so then in 1925, it's reimagined as a mother and baby home. And she used to pass it as a little girl. And so now here she is. She's a grandmother, and she decides to do some local history. And she's doing basic research, but no one is really helping her. There's no real records available to her. And one of the things she figures out is that, there were a lot of children who died here over the years, 796. That's a lot of children to have died in a place that's being run by a religious order whose charism is nursing, okay? And so the children are dying of gastroenteritis and marasma, which is marasmus, which is malnutrition, and all sorts of other things. So she finds the death records, but there are no burial records. She can't figure out where they're buried, and that leads her on to this journey where she says, "Well, they might be buried here on these grounds in this old Victorian era septic system." And so she's that causes the news a few years ago that you and I remember. And then it kind of faded away, in part because it hadn't been proven. So I knew about it. Choom's about maybe 40 miles from where my mother grew up. And Catherine actually reminds me a lot of my mother in certain ways. And so then in March, a government commission created to investigate what Catherine was alleging, as well as the conditions and the intricacies of all the mother and baby homes that existed at the time in Ireland, announced, you know, yes, it's true. We have found significant human remains on the grounds here. And they only examined one little corner of the property. The property is about 7 acres now. The building has been knocked down. There's housing on parts of the property, and the rest of it is a playground. So you imagine that children are playing above the bones of children. It's a very sobering, disturbing image. Yeah. So the government says, yeah, there are human remains there. Not only are there human remains there, but they're not famine bones. We've done the testing, and these are the bones of children ages, you know, just a few days to 3 years, including fetal remains. And in fact, they date to the time when the mother and baby home was in operation. So this is, you know, 20th century human remains, not 19th century human remains. So when colleagues of mine and I saw that, and having seen how the story had been covered over the years, we said, you know, there's another way to tell this story, to slow it down, really, and go back and put it in historical context, but also to get to know this woman, Catherine Corliss, a little better. And her journey is really extraordinary. You know, she's not a historian by training. She's not a politician. She's not a journalist. She's a woman who has raised a family, is now helping to take care of grandchildren. She's a gardener. She has some artistic talent. And she is curious. And all those, and then when she figured what was going on, she became fiercely determined to have these children who were buried there remembered in some way, because it was basically a plot or rather grounds where there's no commemoration really of all those children.
Can you tell us about the children, about the religious order, a little bit of that background as well, which
sure.
would be, for many of us, would be just as well pleased not to even bring it up.
I know, that speaks to something else. But I would preface my remarks by saying that this wasn't peculiar only to Ireland. You know, there were other countries, including the United States, that had facilities like these. Though in Ireland, I would say that, one, they were run by the religious orders, and two, there was a... and most of them were Catholic. Not all of them were. There were a couple that were run by Protestants and a few run by the state, but they were mostly Catholic orders who ran these facilities. And they were established at a time in Ireland when the government was brand new. I mean, it was a new country in a way. And so the government is dealing with all sorts of issues. And so they effectively handed over many of the social issues to the Catholic Church, okay? And so among those were the issue of women who have become pregnant outside of marriage and their children. And at the time, there was great shame associated with this situation. So, for example, if my mother... having been raised in Shenanigans in a small village, had become pregnant outside of marriage, that would have brought shame not only on her family, but arguably to her parish. And the local pastor would have come to the house and said, you have to get her out of here. You have to, it's not a good example for the rest of the parish. You have to get her out of here. Now, some families, I will tell you, would tell that priest to get lost. There's evidence of families just saying, we'll take care of it. But many families felt the pressure of the Catholic Church and the pressure of the local community to acquiesce. And what would happen is that young woman would be taken often at night, so as to use the dark of night as a kind of a curtain, and be brought to Tuam, to the St. Mary's home in Tuam. and then she would stay there. She would give birth oftentimes at a hospital in Galway, but then she would be at the home for the first year of the baby's life, breastfeeding the baby, and then working off her food and shelter by doing domestic chores around the home, cleaning the floors, cleaning the mattresses, what have you. And then roughly after about a year, she would be told, well, it's time to go. And it was clear that she would not be taking her child with her because, you know, arguably she could not very well return to her home in, say, Shenanigans with a one-year-old baby. So she would be shown the door. Though the nuns that were running this particular home, the Bon Secours, would take effort to find her a job, maybe as a domestic, maybe in Dublin or maybe in London, or find her some kind of position. The idea here was rehabilitation, you know, redemption after your great sin. Though if that woman became pregnant a second time, it was called a second offense. And that was extremely serious in this context. And she often would be taken to the Magdalen laundries. And no one wanted to go to the Magdalen laundries. And oftentimes, as we all know now, women would live and die there. They would spend their entire life there.
So, as a punishment, definitely beyond reason. But again, on the Magdalen laundries, can you just give us a rundown on what they were?
Sure. I'm hardly an expert. I mean, there are plenty of experts on this, and there's a wonderful documentary and a movie about the Magdalen laundries.
Yep.
But they were set up in the 19th century mostly to take in prostitutes. And then by the 20th century, that had been transformed into accepting women who were considered to be vulnerable, naive, promiscuous, flirtatious, sometimes too pretty to be out there. And so they were taken in and into these facilities, often run by religious orders, right? And they would work. They would do the laundry for others, and they would not be paid, and it would not be made clear to them that they could leave. And if one ran away, oftentimes the police would track them down and bring them back. It was a very strange and troubling slice of Irish social life at the time. So if you're a vulnerable woman in Ireland, particularly in rural Ireland, and you become pregnant, you might go to the mother and baby home. And if you became pregnant again, you would go to the Magdalen laundry. So there's evidence. Or you might, Adrian, you might go, if you were troublesome, you might go to the asylum in Ballinasloe. You would go to they would say, oh, you're mentally unwell, and they would just put you in a psychiatric facility.
Was the my guest friend is Dan Barry. I just want to see if we can clarify the role of the government. Granted, you know, it's a new government and they have their growing pains. Were they continuing a tradition, or did they come up with this by default in banishing, you know, of taking care of the, you know, less fortunate, because it wasn't just those young girls who became pregnant, something we definitely wouldn't want to delve too much into as Irish, a lot of times through incest.
Right.
What did the government just, so we don't, you know, cast the blame solely on the religious orders?
I wouldn't do that at all. I think you're exactly right. It is not solely... The religious orders and the Catholic Church in some way were really working in service to the state, okay? Mm-hmm. So the state came up with this program and then, you know, enlisted the religious orders to work, to take in these people. these vulnerable people. There is at play here, as many Irish historians will tell you, a great misogyny. There's a great element of the subjugation of women at this time, okay? So they're already considered a lower class within the structure. And then what's worse than that than to have become pregnant outside of a wedlock, and you're already a second-class citizen, and now you're something even lower. So the Irish state created this system, and they were supposed to, they financed it. They helped, it could be the, so for example, in Galway, it would be the Galway County Council who would be funding the Tuam home. But they were also supposed to maintain a regulatory function. They were supposed to be checking in not only on the ledger of it, not only on the money accounting aspect of it, but also, are these children being taken care of? Are they being fed properly? Are they being raised properly? And there was a lot of debate within Irish government over the many years about the propriety of this system. But the hand in glove relationship between the government of that time and the Catholic Church won out. You know, there's plenty of evidence of health officials, including a woman who looks like a heroine in retrospecting, Alice Litster, who, by the way, was Protestant, so she was perhaps bucking against the system at the time as well, who was saying this is an outrage. These poor children, these poor women, we are not treating them properly. And her entreaties fell on deaf ears at the time. So you're exactly right. It's not only the Catholic Church, it's really the state. This was what was considered best at the time.
Was it common? Were the religious orders who were taking in particular these mother and baby, the mothers who got pregnant, but just taking one aspect of it. The mother got to spend the first year, as you pointed out, with the baby. To even imagine that after 1 year you were, you know, shown the door, as it were. Was that followed by visiting rights by the mother for the baby? Was there a kind of, it sounds a little bit like, you know, the cow and the calf, that, you know, after a relatively short period of time, there's a separation. And we even, you know that a tremendous sense of, you know, parenthood and how traumatic it is, even for animals.
Mm-hmm. I know. Life is complicated. The human condition is complicated. And there may be some women, some mothers who were relieved, you know, who had gone through something, and the only way that they could deal with it was to make a break of it and go on to London or maybe the United States and start afresh. But there's plenty of anecdotal evidence of the heartbreak and the harrowing separation between mother and child forced upon them by this system. And there's a fellow in Menlock in Galway, not too far from Ballinasloe, named P.J. Haverty. And he was effectively raised in the home until he was about seven. He has almost no memory of the home. Most of the adult home babies, as they were called, now in their 60s and 70s, have almost no memory of the place. And I think of that as perhaps a coping mechanism. They blocked it out. But years later, he was able to track down his birth mother, who was living in London. And, you know, he had many, many problems. He had been called a bastard when he was a teenager. He was ostracized. He has a horrible story of his young adulthood, his teenage years and young adulthood, and how he was treated poorly by his community. So he finally finds his mother, and she, you know, he has feelings of abandonment. And she says, oh, no. She said, they kicked me out, and so I got a job at the local hospital right in Tuam. She wasn't from Tuam. And And I worked 6 days, and on my seventh day, every day off, for 5.5 years, I went back to the home and banged on the door and demanded that I be given my child. And I want to rear him. I want to take him home with me. And she was ripped off. The door would close. And then she finally went on to London, and he was able to track her down. So that might be more typical or more reflective of exactly what you're saying, that pain of separation.
Yeah. Let's talk briefly about those who survived, the babies who reached adulthood, and obviously they couldn't all be employed, housed by the religious institutions. At what point was there an exit strategy for them?
What would happen to those children would be that their mothers would leave when they were maybe about 1 year old. Their mothers would disappear. And then they would be raised by the nuns and the nuns' assistants and by the other mothers. And then when they were about 4.5 or 5, they would clatter down to the local elementary schools. There were two, one run by the Sisters of Mercy and one run by the Presentation Sisters. And they would be separated. School would start at a certain hour, and they would always be late. And this was by design. So they would walk a quarter or half mile down the Dublin Road to these schools, which were side by side, and they would be late. And, you remember, if you were late for school, you might get a slap upside the head or a slap on the wrist. That was their daily occurrence. And then once they were in the classroom, they were separated in a certain way. They sat at the back of the class. And Catherine Corliss remembers that they had almost no presence. They were never engaged in any conversation. Then at lunchtime, the quote-unquote legitimate children were told to stay away from them, not to engage with them. And then before the end of the day, these home babies would leave early. And then they would disappear behind these big walls where the home was. And so then when they were about 6 or 7, or say 7, they would receive their first Holy Communion, because that was very important to the Catholic Church, that they received at least the first Holy Communion. And then they would be adopted out, or fostered out, or sent to an industrial school. And what would happen is that potential foster families would come to the home, and the children would be gathered in some kind of rec room. And oftentimes, the parents, the would-be parents would be looking for people who could help them on the farm. So they'd be looking for a boy who was big for his age, or a girl who might be able to help them around the house.
Now they already had existing families. We'd have to imagine that the number couples, parents that came in to look around to adopt a 6-7 year old. That most of them were bringing that foster child into an already established family.
I don't have any statistics on this, Adrian, but I think what was often happening was that it would be an older couple, okay, and so maybe their children had already grown up and moved away, or it was an older couple who didn't have any children. And the sisters would be careful, though. Woman who worked there later said that the sister who was in charge was very careful, at least for a little while, not to foster out one of the home children to a family where there were several other children, because she knew that that meant that that child would be treated almost like a servant. So she would try not to do that. But on the other hand, if you were being fostered out to an older couple, they would become very reliant on you to do a lot of the work as the mother and father, the man and wife grew older. Yeah. So that was the dynamic. Then is the question of these adoptions. As you know, that in the late 40s and early 50s, this became a huge scandal in Ireland, the shadowy operation of adoptions, illegal adoptions. You know, Jane Russell, the movie actress, coming over to Ireland and just like picking a child the way you might pick a car.
Yes.
And going home with that child. So there's some evidence that that also happened. And then lastly, you might wind up at the industrial school, which was, you know, like Oliver Twist.
Yeah. I'm sure a lot of people in the United States who, as you say, might have gone to pick, you know, the best of the crop or somebody, some youngster that they would like to adopt. Did that secrecy with respect to, illegally fostering out, as it were, these young kids, to what degree were many of them, say, sent to America rather than England or, you know, other places? Do we even know?
I know there are many, but I don't have any statistics on that. In fact, when the story appeared in the New York Times online, there was a feature that allowed you to write a comment, to chime in with a comment about your reaction to the piece. And one of the editors alerted me to a note just this morning, from a woman who grew up in one of these homes in Dublin, a mother and baby home in Dublin, and was adopted, and the address that she gave is Riverhead, Long Island. And you could see in her words that the pain of that process and the sense of abandonment and how did she wind up here? So it did happen, but I don't know how many.
I want to return again, a topic it would be very comfortable not to even address, but you have done it in such an amazing manner. The disposition of mostly babies by the religious orders. What was the stigma? Would that have accounted for, you know, some of the reason that, you know, a baby, for instance, or a youngster was not returned to the family for the family grave? How did they wind up in the graves, and particularly in a septic tank on the property?
You know, Adrian, I'm here to tell you, I don't know the answer. What I can tell you is that the stigma of illegitimacy, and that's in quotes, illegitimacy, was very, very profound. And so, in fact, when Catherine was trying to figure out, well, we have all these death certificates, where are these children buried? And the first answer she got from the Bon Secours nuns and from the Galway County Council was, you know what, true, they're not in the cemetery, which is literally across the street from the home, okay?
Right.
The Troom Cemetery is across the street from the home. They're not buried there. And so the Galway County Council and the Bon Secours were suggesting, well, probably the families collected the bodies of these poor children and buried them back in their home places. Now, Catherine knew that that was nonsense, and she knew it was nonsense because of the stigma that was attached to illegitimacy. So, in other words, these families who basically shunned their daughters or their sisters for having gotten pregnant certainly were not and never visited, would not then come to that home to collect the remains of of that poor child who died, and then bring that child back to the home place and have that child buried in consecrated ground under their surname. That was just not going to happen. So that's an example of the great stigma here. And also, when the children were in school, okay, and now they're having some exposure to the wider population beyond the gray walls of the home, they were considered children of the devil. They were considered, even though they were baptized, they were considered the devil's spawn, and they were treated as such. And so other kids were told to stay away from them, in part because they were, you know, as I said in the story, they had the hint of sulfur around them.
The story, indeed, is very graphic, and nobody has, you know, even pieced together, you know, what you, you know, have written, or if they did piece it together, they didn't divulge it. Finally, I want to ask you about the burial ground itself on the premises, and when we talk about a mass grave, perhaps you'll describe, again, for as painful as it is, you know, how the mass grave was handled and how it was, how it became that way. If we're talking about almost 800 children, obviously the grounds would not allow, and I'm, you know, in trying to make some excuses for the religious order, which many of us didn't have any problem with. But how and why was, in Chum in particular, why was that mass grave in a sewer, in a septic tank? Why was that chosen?
So we don't know the extent here, Adrian. So the earlier report said, as I said, 796 babies buried in a septic tank. That is not really what happened here. So, and also, I agree with you about religious orders and about these nuns and being careful to attach evil to what happened here. I don't know what the reasons were. It could have been as simple as they didn't have enough money to pay the few pounds to bury the children across the street, in part because so many children were dying. It could be purely financial, weirdly as that may sound. But anyway, so these 7 acres, you know, it was a workhouse built in the 19th century, and it had a very elaborate Victorian-era septic system. And back then it would be a series of tunnels and little chambers underneath the ground, okay? And then by the 1930s, the home was attached to the town sewer system. So that septic system built in the 19th century no longer needed to be used. And it was large enough where you could walk through it. It was like tunnels. Just imagine tunnels that you could pretty much stand in. And at some point, these children, after death, were being their bodies were being placed there. Now, I wouldn't suggest that they were being thrown or anything like that.
Or dumped.
What we know is, or dumped, no, and we were careful not to use that kind of language. And so, as you know from the story, in the 1970s, a local woman, a well-respected woman, who's a huge champion of travelers in Ireland, she was a young mother at the time, and she fell through a hole while walking on the property for some reason, and she saw these bundles, and they were stacked neatly, but they were stacked sort of, she says, like packages in a grocery, as far as she could see down the tunnel. So we know that, and we know that a couple of years earlier, two boys had fallen into a hole, or they'd lifted a cement top aside, and they looked down, and they saw a bunch of skulls and bones. So there could have been changes in how these children were buried over the years. I really don't know. But I would say to you that they haven't examined the entire property yet. What we do know is that there are significant remains, many significant remains. That's according to the government. That's not according to a local report. That's the government.
As this story unfolded, and as you have so given us such a descriptive statement of facts, can we then disassociate ourselves from that aspect of it and perhaps just shine a light on, first of all, the burden of what the sisters were saddled with, coupled,
yes,
say, with the,
yes,
with the limited financial resources. How were those children treated while they were there? Obviously, the education, despite the stigma, was taken care of. Do we know where was there? Did they have enough food? Did they have enough? Was their care reasonably taken care of?
You know, there are conflicting reports, quite frankly, on that, and it may have waxed and waned. I would say that the sisters did not have enough money being provided to them, and they were often going back to the county council asking for more money or asking for medicine, because if you a case of gastroenteritis would be contagious and run through a ward and kill these vulnerable children. So these children may have come to them not in the greatest of health all the time because of poor prenatal care. I don't know.
Yeah.
They were wearing these hobnail boots that were, not terribly fashionable. There's evidence in the records of children dying of malnutrition. So that's problematic. There could be various reasons for that. There's evidence that the children were seen, as quite frankly, as something less, because they were, yes, baptized, but they were illegitimate. And it wasn't, I would not say that it was a happy place.
Dan Barry, you've brought to light a story that, as we all know, was fading into the background, as many Irish stories do when they are hard to take. How do we get the story? How online can those who did not get the New York Times last Sunday for that lead story? How do we?
Sure. If you just go to the New York Times website, which would be www.nytimes.com, and if you go to the search window, which is at the top of the screen, and just type in the lost children of Tuam, T-U-A-M, you'll find the story. And you can also search by my name, Dan Barry. And there's both a long story about the case and also a documentary where you hear P.J. Haverty and some other adult home babies describe their lives.
I want to thank you for joining us. I know that first of all you're out of town, and we really appreciate you bringing to us not only the great story in the New York Times, but also to tell it in your own words. I thank you very much, Dan.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Adrian. Take care of yourself.
Thanks. And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network USA again.